This is the first episode in a series of talks recorded at Te Pātakatoi at an art gallery titled Through a Contemporary Lens, Artists in Response. The series features five Te Upoko o Te Ika a Māui based artists who were invited to share their response to particular photographs in the exhibition A Different Light, First Photographs of Aotearoa. In this episode, we hear interdisciplinary artist and educator Caroline Macquarie responding to Robina Nichols' portrait of Amy Kirk yawning from circa 1899. With a 21st century understanding of the gendered gaze in photography, Macquarie explores what it might have meant to be an amateur female photographer in the late 19th century and how we locate her photographic practice now. As you listen, if you'd like to look at this photograph and others mentioned in this episode, follow the link to the Adam Art Gallery website.
Ngā mihi, thank you. I want to particularly thank the Adam team and Kate for organising this series. I think it's really lovely, particularly with an exhibition like this, in which it's not possible to hear from the practitioners who made the images other than through the images themselves. Really appreciate the opportunity to invite some photographic practitioners into the space and to sort of respond to and think about the works that are in the exhibition in perhaps a different way than the curators have thought about the works. So just, yeah, really appreciate that opportunity. And also just really great to see a lot of photography in town at the moment, which is really great. We made a few copies of the image so that you could have a close look at it if you haven't had a chance to look. But also if you want to be sort of having a look at it while I'm talking, there's maybe not enough for everybody. So if you could share them, that would be awesome. So yeah, I'm going to talk to you today about this lovely small photograph titled Amy Kirk Yawning, Wearing a Black Armband, made by Wellington-based photographer Robina Nichols, probably in 1899, which makes it the most recent photograph in this exhibition. I was initially going to speak also to two of the images on the other side of this case, those by Margaret Matilda White, which is titled Who Are Private Hospital Nurses and Mr. Hodson Smoking. You can tell which one that is because you can see the nurses. Thanks, Louise, for pointing that out. And also the one at this end by Elizabeth Hocken, Gladys, and her father, T. Morland Hocken, from 1892. But in the end, however, I actually found that I really have enough to say just about this photo. But I also, the ideas that I'm going to be talking about in relation to this photo, I think, relate to those as well. So maybe having a think about sort of all three of them. So my intention today is to discuss this photograph specifically, but also maybe to offer some provocations about the way that we think about photographs made by women, both historical and contemporary, which is quite a big ask for quite a little photo, but I think it's really up to the task. So Amy, I'm going to start by just talking a little bit specifically about the photograph. So Amy Kirk Yawning is a contemporary digital print made from a digital scan of the original quarter plate sized dry plate gelatin glass silver negative. It's a lot of words. I'll explain what they mean. So you may be familiar with flexible film negatives, which come on a roll, enabling you to take multiple photographs before having the film developed. But at this point in photographic history, negatives were a single sheet of glass, much like the one over here in this case, which you might have had a look at, each having to be placed into a light, tight film holder inside a dark room, which could then be transferred into the camera, like this one, in the light outside in the world. Quarter plate negatives were about 8 by 11 centimetres, pretty much the size of the images that's been printed, probably exactly the size of the images that's been printed. And they'd been around since the mid-1800s. But an important advance in the technology in the late 19th century was a process called dry plate. This method differed from what was used before in that the photographic emulsion lasted much longer than the previously used wet plate method, which needed to be exposed to light while it was still wet, which is how it got the name, which necessitated the photographer to manufacture the negative themselves and then quickly take the photo after the plate had been coated. So dry plate negatives, on the other hand, like the one that Nichols used, could be pre-coated in a factory and shipped out to keen photographers around the world. So why does this matter? This change in technology enabled new groups of people to practice photography, previously only open to those who either made photography a business or were independently wealthy enough to be able to afford the expensive equipment and all of the materials. The smaller quarter plate size, which meant a smaller camera, so much smaller than this one in the case, and the introduction of dry plate technology were steps towards snapshot photography as we know it today. And that's how they've been framed in this exhibition. Even as this photo was taken, rolls of film were being produced in America by the Kodak Eastman Company. The famously easily accessible camera and film system, the Box Brownie, would be patented the year following this photograph. And within a few short years, photography would become even more accessible still as that technology became widely available in Aotearoa, New Zealand. All of which means that this photograph was made at a time when the medium was in a transition technically. Although what you learn fairly quickly when you look at the history of photography is that it is really always in transition technically. However, some technological shifts are more fundamental, not perhaps for their own sake, but for the ways in which they change how we use photography. Because of these continual shifts in technology, photography has been notoriously difficult to define as a medium, and trying to do so by defining a specific technology, which is probably how most people think of photography by referencing cameras, inevitably ends up leaving important elements of the medium out. One of the best definitions that I've come across is one by Jeffrey Batchin in a 1999 essay titled Ectoplasm, Photography in the Digital Age, where he states, in any case, if we continue to identify photography with certain archaic technologies such as camera and film, these technologies are themselves the embodiment of the idea of photography, or more accurately, of a persistent economy of photographic desires and concepts. The concepts inscribed within this economy would have to include such things as nature, knowledge, representation, time, space, observing subject, and observed object. Thus, if we do have to define it for a moment, we might say that photography is the desire, or not, to orchestrate a particular set of relationships between these various concepts. So you'll note that he doesn't mention cameras at all. So what Batchin is saying here is that photography is not the technology itself. Photography is the way that we use that technology. And at the end of his essay, which was written in response to predictions in the 1990s about the end of the medium due to the transition to digital, the conclusion that he comes to is that photography will continue to exist as long as we who make it still need it. Which is something to keep in mind amidst all this talk of AI, but that's an avenue I'm not going down this week. So this little photograph was taken on the cusp of a seismic shift in the medium, a shift which would take cameras out of the hands of the few and into the lives and homes of the many. Robina Nichols' photograph, along with the others included in this section, are positioned within this exhibition and in the accompanying book as being the immediate precursors to that change which happened right at the beginning of the 20th century. So what do we know of Robina Nichols, the photographer, and for that matter, Amy Kirk, who we see yawning in this photograph? Robina Nichols was born in Shetland in Scotland in 1861 and emigrated with her family aged 13. The family settled in Nelson, and when she married Alexander Scott Nichols, a pipe maker, in 1885, she moved to Wellington, where they lived for the rest of their lives on Austin Street, Mount Victoria. The couple did not have children, and Nichols was involved in their local Baptist church and the temperance movement. We also know that she signed the suffrage petition in 1893. The Nichols probably weren't wealthy. They probably weren't poor either, and not having children might have meant that they had a little bit more disposable income than some families. But the democratization of photography at the time meant that people like Nichols could afford to experiment with photography, buying cameras, glass plates, and making her own prints, probably on commercially produced printing out paper. Nichols worked making photographs between the 1890s and the 1920s, and she actually continued to use the dry plate method long past when it was sort of the popular method and film had come in, mostly photographing scenes from her life, which included her friends, often in gardens and out in the landscape, children, Baptist church activities, and scenes mostly in Wellington, but some also in Whanganui and Rotorua. A lot of her photographs, and for me the most appealing ones, are of her and her friends, either sitting together in gardens or walking in the bush or in the hills. She seemed to love the outdoors and being out in the world. Nicole often appears in her own photographs, and she looks to me to be a happy, strong, vital person, someone who I actually really feel that I would like to meet. I actually just, as an aside, I just wrote a post for National Library. It's gone out on their Facebook yesterday, and it's going onto their blog as part of a series of people responding to images in the National Library. And I wrote about another of Nicole's photographs, one where she and a friend are out amongst some bracken, and it's a self-portrait, and they look like they've been for a really brisk walk, and it's a really lovely, sort of vibrant photograph. So this portrait is a photograph of Amy Kirk, who often appears in Nicole's images. The Kirk family lived on Brougham Street in Mount Victoria, close to the Nicholls home, and both families attended the same church. Thomas Kirk died in 1898, and this photograph shows Amy, one of his 9 children, wearing a black mourning armband. So it's the band around her arm, which I would imagine is how the photograph has been dated, 1899. Amy Kirk was a strong advocate of the temperance movement, and in the essay about Nicole, Natalie Marshall quotes a church newsletter which calls her speaker among the women of the Dominion in her day, which I think is a really lovely thing to know about this person. The temperance movement was popular in late 19th century. It aimed to make alcohol illegal. To our contemporary sensibilities, that might make those who supported it seem a little bit like sort of stuffy busybodies, but the reality at the time was often quite different, although maybe some of them were, but you know, it was perhaps a broad church. Temperance was a movement often taken up by women who these days we would consider feminist and progressive, alongside suffrage or the right to vote. This was because married women at the time had no control over money or property. Everything belonged to their husband, and they relied entirely on their husband's ability to be good managers of the household budget. Husbands spending money on alcohol rather than passing along to their wives in order to feed and clothe their families was seen as a particular problem in English-speaking countries in the late 19th century, and banning alcohol was regarded as a way of that money being directed back towards the women and children. This movement eventually led to prohibition in the USA from 1920 to 1933, which was widely regarded as a failure, and the idea fell out of favour. However, prior to that, in the late 1890s, when this photo was taken, many women saw temperance as a way to increase the agency of women, particularly those in the working classes. So we can probably surmise that Robin and Nicole Kirk shared beliefs and probably worked together in the church, temperance, and perhaps suffrage movements. In other words, they were friends, which is a very long-winded way of saying what we can actually see immediately in the photograph itself. Amy Kirk is clearly comfortable being photographed by Nicole, and Nicole knows her sitter well enough to take this candid image of her friend while she was yawning. The backdrop of the photo is a black cloth hung on a fence, and I like to think that Amy Kirk was a little bit bored, waiting for her friend to set up her camera and to get everything ready. Perhaps she had sat or stood through this ritual many times before. Perhaps she had been up late the previous night. So she leans back and yawns, and Nicole, perhaps without finishing her preparations, quickly took the photo. I imagine the friends laughing after the moment itself, and I love the idea that such a photo would be kind of an in-joke among intimate friends. Of course, the image could have been planned, but I suspect not, because the focus isn't in the right place. Kirk's back arm, as she leans back, is in the plane of focus, and that wouldn't be where her face would be if she was standing where she was and she wasn't yawning, which suggests that Nicole actually wasn't quite ready to take the portrait, but couldn't help herself when it was presented to her. And so in that way, it feels quite spontaneous. There are other appealing aspects to the photograph. I'm drawn to Kirk's clothing, the lace edging and the collar on her blouse, the pointed belt and the brooch at her neck. The armband adds another layer to the image. It feels almost shocking to see someone in mourning photographed in a relaxed and casual way in this time period, which also probably hints at the intimacy between the photographer and the sitter. So, what can we make of the fact that Robina Nicol was a woman photographing at a time when photography was largely a male pastime? Perhaps not that much, but I'm going to make quite a lot of it. Nicol is not, I believe, photographing here like a man. And I don't make that statement lightly, because in the end, how can we actually quantify what a man photographs like and what a woman photographs like? But one answer to that question is to look around you at this exhibition, because most of the photographs in this exhibition are made by men, all apart from the 3 that I've mentioned, and the one in this case, which is the really incredible 10x12 glass plate negative taken by Elizabeth Pullman in the 1880s. We know from Lisa Mitchell, who's here, incredible primary research in her book Three Shaded Glass, which was published by Te Papa Press 2 years ago, which I highly recommend, that there were many women photographers active in this period. Sadly, some of their photographs have been lost, but not all of them, and particularly those of women working commercially. And when I say lost, they may not be actually lost. They may be, there's a good chance that they are in family collections, that people have them because they would have, the photographs would have been taken home by the people who bought them. So we know that this is an exhibition pulled from collections, and one of the things that we might consider here is whether early photographic curators who were acquiring work for those collections saw particular value in collecting photographs made by both women and also by Māori. If we accept that Nicola's not photographing like a man, what do I actually mean by that? So the intimacy in this photo is clear. The two women on either side of the camera know each other, like really know each other. Am I saying that men can't take intimate photos? No, of course not. But if we look to the formality of commercial studio portraits of the time, they do not have anything like the ease and informality of these three photographs. And when men take intimate photos of women, the word can take on different connotations. Of course, it doesn't have to. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. If a full range of human emotions and experience is being represented in our culture, great. If everyone gets to see themselves represented in a way that reflects who they are as fully realized human beings, great. But there's a reason that this photo and the Margaret Matilda White and the Elizabeth Hocken photos stand out a little bit. It's because they're giving us a peek into a world that the rest of the exhibition does not. And it's a woman's world where women relate to each other and to their families different than they relate to men. So how do we explain the fact that these photographs feel somewhat surprising in relation to the rest of the exhibition? And we have some theories, one of which is the feminist theory of the male gaze. I'm going to do something I don't usually do here, but on this topic, this is actually a very good source. Wikipedia tells us that the concept of the gaze, and when I say gaze here, spelling with a Z, was first used by the English art critic John Berger in Ways of Seeing in 1972, which presents analyses of the representation of women as passive objects to be seen in advertising and as nude subjects in European art. The feminist intellectual Laura Mulvey applied the concepts in her 1975 essay Visual Pleasure and Narrative Cinema to critique traditional representations of women in cinema, from which work emerged the concept and term of the male gaze. End quote. So this canon absolutely has been applied to still photography along with moving image. It suggests that any viewer of a photograph puts themselves into the place of the assumed male photographer. John Berger, in his influential 1972 book and TV show Ways of Seeing, famously stated, "Men look at women. Women watch themselves being looked at. This determines not only most relations between men and women, but also the relation of women to themselves. The surveyor of woman in herself is male, the surveyed is female." Of course, all of this has been theorized and written almost 80 years after this photograph is taken, but we do know that photography very quickly adopted the tropes and prejudices of painting in the 19th century. So we cannot state that 19th century photography was free of the prejudices that photography would come to embody more fully in the 20th century, particularly advertising photography, which Berger relates in that very excellent TV series and book to early paintings of nudes in his discussions of the gaze. So the reason that I bring this up and the wider point that Berger and Mulvey are making is to remind the viewer of any photograph or any film, that the person making it was not, as we've often been led to believe, a neutral observer. That every photographer comes to their image, to the image making, with their beliefs and prejudices and imbues their work with them, consciously or not. And if the majority of people making those images come from one demographic, then that demographic's way of seeing the world will be privileged. So when we look at Nicola's photographs and we see images of her home, her friends, and her walks in the hills, rather than what were considered at the time serious subjects, and we add to that the knowledge that she never worked as a commercial photographer, if we judge her by conventional standards, we would have to label Nicola an amateur. And that is what this exhibition and the accompanying book does. Nicola is placed into the amateur sort of snapshot section. But I would like to take a few minutes to consider that categorization. So the terms amateur and professional denote, of course, whether a photographer makes money from their work. And in that regard, we cannot consider Rabena Nicol a professional photographer. But they also have the connotation, that of serious and not serious. The assumption is that if one is taking their photography seriously, then it is either their profession or perhaps they're simply important people. And interestingly, we have that kind of categorization right from the beginning of photography with the two people who are credited with the invention of it, with Jacques Daguerre, who invented the daguerreotype, was working in a very commercial way, and William Henry Fox Talbot, who invented the positive-negative process, who had connections to the British Royal Society and was a very wealthy upper-class individual. But what if, because of one's gender, there are substantial barriers to that profession? How then do we judge the seriousness of the endeavour? We might look to the camera club, institutions well established in the late 1890s as a way to find photographic community and improve your photographic skills, and in which many people who took photography really seriously found community. We find in the records of those institutions that many women joined, or some women joined, and some took their photography very seriously indeed. Yet there is no evidence of Rabena Nicol ever joining a camera club in Wellington, meaning that Nicol was not a serious photographer. Okay, her technical ability. The accompanying book to this exhibition notes that often lack of technical skill marked out the amateur, with double exposures and out-of-focus photographs being common mistakes of those in this class. We know that there are examples of both of those things in the collection of Nicol's dry plate negatives, and the National Library has added a label out-of-focus in their categorisation of the image, because I screenshotted that off the National Library website, so you can see that there on the page. Yet all of us learning a skill make mistakes, and perhaps others were simply more careful to get rid of the evidence of the ones that didn't work. So do her technical mistakes mark Nicol out as not a serious photographer? Do we then look to her subject matter? Photography from its inception swiftly gravitated to the genres already in use by painting in order to make itself sensible to both early practitioners and audience, and to claim a space, or to attempt to claim a space in the art realm rather than in science. If one wanted to be noticed in the art photography world in the 19th century, one would photograph landscapes, formal studio portraits, still life, or the tableau, a form largely derived from history painting, but which still persists as a very well-established genre in art photography today. Nicol largely photographed her friends and her family in her home garden and the hills around Wellington, not any of those genres. So does this mean she was not a serious photographer? To many contemporary sensibilities, all of these things matter less than they did in the 19th century. Photographers such as Sally Mann, Nan Goldin, and even earlier than Rabena Nicol in the UK, in some respects Julia Margaret Cameron, have all shown that meaningful work can be made when one photographs, in Nan Goldin's words, one's own tribe. These photographers and others like them have sometimes consciously chosen to deliberately ignore the correct technical ways to make photographs. They are also all, consciously or not, actively choosing to either step outside of Burge's paradigm, women watch themselves being looked at, or to subvert it. One way to challenge being looked at is to look back really hard and to engage the watcher as much as the watched. So where does this leave us with Nicol? I'm a little torn. On the one hand, what does it matter if she's considered an amateur photographer? She certainly fits the categorization. What difference does it make to me if I love her photographs and her insights into her world? Is that not enough? Somehow for me it is not. As a practitioner, not an historian, I cannot help but put myself in her place, and when I am there, I want to break the walls of those categorizations down. It is entirely possible that Rabena Nicol was happy with her forays into photography, that even if she were given more opportunity in a differently organized society, she would still have made exactly what she made, that she may have even happily labeled herself as amateur, but we don't know. As someone who educates young photographers, the majority of whom are women, I'm acutely aware that it can take a great deal of encouragement for women practitioners to take the steps necessary to become a serious photographer. The encouragement is needed to undo limiting expectations placed upon them in a number of ways by our society, to undo the subconsciously absorbed idea that men take photographs and women have their photographs taken, or these days, that women take photographs of themselves in a certain kind of way. And if they make those steps, they may find that certain subject matter gain more encouragement. A particular way of working technically might be seen as more legitimate. We still have a keen idea of whose work is amateur and whose work is professional, who sits within the canon and who without. We revere those whose work we take seriously and we dismiss those whose work we don't. And in a world saturated with imagery, perhaps that is one way to find ourselves not drowning in an avalanche of photographs. But who decides whose work is serious? Those decisions are made by people who exist in gatekeeping positions, largely curators, publishers, gallerists, and academics like myself. And it often happens in the art world that those photographers we take seriously are the people with the big cameras using expensive film who stride out in the world rather than photograph in their own homes. I'm not immune from that world and I function within that system, but I do notice who gets noticed and, more importantly, who does not. Perhaps in the end, the point I'm trying to make is this, that when we categorise objects which are as culturally complex as photographs using inherited frameworks, we inevitably end up reproducing established inequalities. If we go back to Batchin's quote and remind ourselves that photographic technologies are themselves the embodiment of photography, or more accurately, of a persistent economy of photographic desires and concepts, we might ask ourselves which desires and concepts might be considered more important. And if we can really say that the subjects of photographs made by recognised figures within the photographic canon are objectively more important than those chosen like someone like Nicol. Sorry, if we can say that. Both capture something of the past. Both led us into worlds we couldn't otherwise see. If stating that one photographic world is inherently more important, more serious than the other, then we are likewise saying that some parts of life are more important and more serious. I still gravitate towards Nicol's photographs and the way she uses a camera. This photograph as Amy Kirk is one of the more light-hearted images she produced, but it sits within a body of work that clearly demonstrates a woman utilising photography to engage meaningfully with her world. The fact that her world is domestic and limited in scale doesn't make it any less interesting or important than the photographs of men who strode out to record industry and sublime landscapes. It just makes it different. If we judge Robina Nicol's photographs as being less valuable than other images, that says more about our values than it does about the photographs. And while we shouldn't project our values back onto the past, we absolutely should examine what our understanding of the past can tell us about ourselves today. Any good historian knows that the way that we tell history is really a reflection of ourselves. Today, women's concerns, particularly those of young, non-white, or socioeconomically disadvantaged women, are often discounted as being less important. Projecting those values onto photography doesn't materially change the photographs, but it might materially change the lives of the people making them. It might make them less visible, give them less opportunities, and reduce their output so that later someone can categorize them as amateur, trapping them in a vicious cycle that they have no way out of. So finally, on Amy Kirk yawning, this photo, I think, sits outside of Burge's Women Watch Themselves Being Looked At. Kirk here is utterly unbothered by being observed. She is unselfconscious in a beguiling, mesmerizing way because she is being photographed by her friend, who is a woman. Kirk and Nicol escape the male gaze, and I am grateful for that brief insight into their world, the world that exists between these two women. And that is me. Thank you very much.